Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Jonathan Lethem, whose new book, The Fortress of Solitude, has recently been published by Doubleday. It's a big novel. It's his biggest book, I think, to date.
Yeah, twice as long as anything before.
Wow.
They've disguised it with nice thin sheets of paper, but it's double the length.
And I want to find a way to go through this book, since a lot of people are talking about it, but it seems to me that they're missing a lot of things. And in the final pages of the book, Jonathan talks about a kind of happier place. The book has been about neighborhoods in Brooklyn, racialisms. The hero of the book has been one of three white children in his public school class. His parents live in that neighborhood of Brooklyn, Gowanus, by choice. They feel they're carrying on the good fight, the old fight, the integration fight. And the boy, to some extent, in very complicated ways, is both the victim and the beneficiary of their liberalism. But by the end of the book, having taken us through many different enclaves in which race, gender, all kinds of questions get subjected to an eye that wants to see both sides of the picture, we come to the kind of art that does not have an interest in sociology or race or gender. It's typified, on the one hand, by the kind of experimental filmmaking that Stan Brakhage was doing, and the boy Dylan's father is himself that kind of filmmaker, and the kind of music that Eno was trying to make during the art rock days. In other words, something that could appeal to popular culture conceivably, but was not of or made from popular culture, stuff that people called the Ivory Tower if they weren't talking about the Academy, but about the sacred precincts of art. And this book seems to be the book in which you investigate as far as you have away from the hermetic.
Yeah, it's very interesting to try to pursue that thread, because I think there is an argument about with myself about what my writing has been for in the book, and this image of the main character's father, Abraham, is a filmmaker kind of in the Brakhage mold, and he's painting on celluloid in this very absolute and super essential and hermetic way. And he's by temperament he's a hermetic guy. And I was thinking about Rothko at the end of his life, painting the endless black and gray canvases, simplifying, purifying color out of his pictures, and obsessed with this image that had reached a kind of limit for him, where he couldn't purify his art any further, and then he reached an apotheosis of despair, having done it. And all of this, of course, happening in a studio on the Bowery, in the middle of New York City, the place I grew up, right around the time I was born into this city full of artists and full of sociology and full of life that I'm now finding myself drawn to depict in this book. And so, yeah, you're right. My earlier books are, in a funny way. I mean, I've been seen as a someone working with the kind of, I always love Stanislaw Lem's description of the junk stratum, working with pop culture junk and fooling around with it. But in fact, my experiment was always pretty
You were an aesthete.
pretty hermetic one. And in this book, I kind of blab all of a sudden that I'm from this place that was intensely sociological, and that I'm enormously confused about it and stimulated to have come from Brooklyn in the 1970s. And so there's Abraham all through the book trying to pretend that he's not in that place, like Rothko painting on the Bowery. The kid, Abraham's son, Dylan, is stuck on the street and in public schools. He doesn't have the opportunity to purify or distill his experience into a kind of hermetic response. He's for better or worse, stuck with the sociology of the body in motion on the street.
Well, he seems in certain ways very much in your shoes, in that there is, on the one hand, one high tradition of disembodied art. Then there's the following after modernism position of, if we are going to have the political novel, the world in which everything is going to enter and it's not going to be a sacred art piece, we are going to imagine a better world, a world of integration, a world of universal suffrage, and it's part of a utopian political ideal. This boy is the child of both of those things. His
yeah.
mother has been an activist, and she is, in a sense, putting her money where her mouth is. She's sending the boy not to a private school but to the public school. And there he is trying to make sense of things in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, moving through those post-idealistic periods where both politics and art get subjected to all kinds of mixing. There's not going to be purity anymore.
Right.
And that seems to be the subject of this book.
Well, I like that description a lot. And of course you're right. I've saddled Dylan, this kid. I've saddled him with my own birthday and address, basically. And by doing that, I wanted to really force myself to stop manipulating experience so indirectly, but to confess a little and start naming some names as to what it was like to be in that place where, you know, it was in the early 70s, this part of Brooklyn was a kind of super laboratory of gentrification and, you know, juxtaposition of cultures and classes just by the chance of, you know, well, there's a lot to that place that made it so, and it was these things were foregrounded by my parents and the kinds of parents that Dylan has and that were typical of the families moving in. They wanted to first they wanted a cheap brownstone, and second they wanted to do something real and that reflected their commitment to the civil rights era, and they couldn't fathom that they were handmaidens to realtors. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like that then. This was before Reagan. This was before the Gulf had opened up that absolutely made everyone choose up sides. There was a kind of negotiation in the middle, and that middle was bohemianism, you know. This was this utopian space where the beautiful American pretense that things are classless and free and we're all going to get along together was being mediated in terms of art and drugs and hippiedom. And
it's still a period in which there are communes. It's an accusation virtually that the artists and political people living in communes are the dupes of their realtors who are using these people to clean up neighborhoods in order so that eventually the people who can pay more will be able to move in. This is, you know, a story sort of like the pre-story of Soho, say,
right,
or of Alphabet Village.
Or any gentrification.
Right,
yeah.
Where what we see first is an artist community moving in, and then a, you know, kind of activist community, and then suddenly the prices go up, the restaurants improve, and you're dealing with another world, a politically correct world in which the problems virtually can't be named.
Right.
I would say that the subject of The Fortress of Solitude by my guest Jonathan Leatham, and you're listening to Bookworm, I'm Michael Silverblatt, is to find a language in the wake of political correctness for the conditions that preceded that, in which the young people, and there are four of them who are central to this book, are in different ways shut down from speaking about their experience, even to one another, because the language has been foreclosed to them.
That's a marvelous description. I was very conscious that this book was about naming the unnameable, sight in a way. And it's terribly specific for me. There were these transactions that occurred that I had no name for. I would go as a New Yorker, moving to California as I did, or spending time in Vermont or Canada. You get the generic question, "Oh, ever been mugged?" And for years, as light as that question seems in some ways, I was tormented by it. I didn't have an answer, because I knew that the asker of the question was envisioning this kind of New Yorker cartoon of the bandit with the handkerchief over his face, asking a well-dressed couple who's just come out of the theater to step into an alley, and then saying, "Your money or your life," and that this had never happened to me. I couldn't say yes to the question, because I knew that I hadn't had that, the kind of mugging that Kojak rescues you from, or Batman. And yet I'd had an enormous number of experiences that were something more than routine childhood bullying. They involved this kind of this negotiation over identity. They were like racial hazing. And they also involved surrendering my pocket money, often every day of a school year, and they always involved shame and double silencing. They were events that were one of their prime characteristic was that they were meant not to have happened after they happened. You know, I really like you. This isn't really happening. We're just friends. What you're not afraid of me, are you? If you were afraid of me, you'd be a racist. So I was dealing with this absolutely gnarled up sense of these acts that often had taken place somewhat humorously. You'd shrug them off. They take place between kids who knew each other, and in another context might be friends or playing or the older brothers of friends. In other words, they were acts of community making. As hostile as they were a conversation. They were a substitution for language. And when I was being identified as, okay, you're the white boy and I'm the black boy, and this is going to happen now because this is what we do, because that's who we are, I was engaging, and not involuntarily, in a theater, a kind of an endless rehearsal of racial meanings in the wake of the civil rights era, I wanted to go back and find names for all of this material.
Well, the four boys who are at the center of the book seem to be a kind of continuum of possibility in that spectrum. There's a white boy, son of liberal, radical, artist, political parents. His name is Dylan. There's another white boy who doesn't have a father in the home. He has a mother there. He's uncharacteristic of this group. And he's, in a sense, a mothered boy. He's been avoiding attacks by feigning asthma attacks. And eventually he's going to be the white who turns black. He gets involved
with super assimilator
drug deals. And there is another boy, Robert, who is ironically given the most Anglo-Saxon of all the names in the book.
Woolfolk.
who is, he's the bully. and he doesn't stir from that. We're going to find him most of the time in jail. He's going to demonstrate to Dylan what it's like to have a mean face and to keep it on all the time.
Right.
And then there's the son of a once prominent musician who is caught between worlds in the same way that Dylan is, that he could easily be gentrified. He belongs to a kind of art royalty.
Right. Well, and also, just as importantly, he's the only one – he's a black kid, but he's the only one of them who's ever been a Boy Scout. He's actually come to this neighborhood out of the suburbs, which is absolutely alien to the experience of the other kids.
Now, do these – I mean, it began to strike me as being like the couples in Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, blonde and fair, dark and you know, that this was a kind of quadrant for a certain focus. Am I right?
I'm delighted by your description. I see all four of them as the key characters in the book, and you know, even though Dylan and Mingus, the sort of most prominent pair, seem to dominate the book, I think Arthur and Robert are absolutely carrying, you know, enormous amounts of weight of meaning. And I see the book in some ways, this is in retrospect, not that I was conscious as I worked, as a series of collapsing communities, attempts at communities and demonstrations of how tenuous and fragile these moments are when the black, white, and Puerto Rican kids on a block are all playing together in a game of Ring Livio or tag or whichever it might be, and everything for a moment is perfect. It's like there's a gelling of that vision, that egalitarian utopian communal reality, and then it slips, turns a corner, and it slips and it's gone. And you know, again and again, you know, the arts college, which has been sort of poisoned with money in the book, and the science fiction convention where uncomfortable people go for, you know, 48 hours and build a momentary community, almost like Burning Man in a hotel somewhere, and claim, you know, it's like a gentrification that lasts for the space of a weekend. And even the young men who gather at the in the auditorium to listen to Stan Brakhage speak, and they're so nervous and freaked out because in Brakhage they've got this vision of what art might really mean, but they can't keep from going at each other's throats before the lecture is over. And so that brief moment of community collapses as well.
Well, this book becomes meaningful and profound for me because I think that while in certain ways it presents itself as being something of a universal experience of growing up in a ghettoized neighborhood subjected to gentrification, I thought that the real subject was that once upon a time, art brought people together.
Right.
That it somehow stopped and there was a replacement set. Comic books did instead. And that comic books had their, you know, value. The whole of pop culture entered that through that crack, and it became comic books, music, and movies, where once it had been the new European films that were coming in, the new traditions of a strange and avant-garde novel, crazier and crazier films and music. In other words, let's leave the racial and the class structure and explore the possibilities of art, and then it becomes, you know, no, it's not going to happen. Pop culture enters and you get instead the ability to enter the world. Eventually, Dylan's father, Abraham, is painting science fiction paperback covers. It's the only way he can make a living. And he enters the world in that way and he gets tributes even.
Yeah.
You're almost feted for compromising.
Right. And that's it. Art is this deeply potent, but profoundly neutral negotiation with the world that can turn on a dime to an hermetic isolation, to empty compromise, to a retreat from community instead of an approach. You know, Dylan as a rock critic, when he grows up, he's a writer of liner notes. He loves soul music. He loves black music so dearly, and yet he's still sort of bricking himself in like a character in Edgar Allan Poe, behind a kind of a wall of fetishes. He's not learning to take it back to community.
Well, now we get to the absolutely complex part of the interview, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. My guest is Jonathan Lethem, author most recently of The Fortress of Solitude, published by Doubleday. Jonathan had been doing something really unusual, which was to create Borgesian, Calvino-esque versions of Westerns, Chandler novels, noir novels, science fiction. In other words, he was in some crazy way gentrifying genre. You know?
Yeah.
And in this book, The Fortress of Solitude, it's as if something has woken up. The language is no longer pared down. Everything is exploding everywhere. The sentences are going for triple their normal length. The metaphors are proliferating like crazy. And this is the book that has earned you the most attention. Does this become part of the conflict? That, in other words, to enter the world in which, yes, I'm going to divide it the way you divided it, between sociology and pop culture, and I'm going to leave art in the attic with the father, and I'm going to enter the world in this way, armed with the load of language you all like and the describing of everything and the big subject, racial tension in the period, in New York, in a place. It's almost as if, could you have done anything more to take a big shot at it? Is this part of a conflict?
The funny thing is, I see the book as more deeply related to the earlier ones than that question supposes, because it's really a culmination of a series of arguments in my work that have led to a greater and greater interest in some of the methods of literary naturalism, which is, I've just also gotten I've turned my interest in genres to the genre of the Bildungsroman, or the genre of, Philip Roth, because Roth is all over this book. I also think that there's something very hard-boiled, actually, in Dylan in the second half of the book, that it's another Chandler novel in its way, the second half of the book, which I call Prison Airs, which is this, ostensible quest for the best friend that turns into the bittersweet discovery of one's own inadequacies. It's basically the long goodbye. The first half of the book is another version, the childhood half of the book is another version of the Western, of the book I was trying to write, and I'm very proud of Girl and Landscape. It's kind of a book of immigrant children on a disputed turf. So I see these deeper relationships, but of course you're right that the outward form it's taken seems so different to people. And
But it's, given that I've been following the work, it's one of those heartbreaking things. Did we always know that you write Goodbye Columbus and you get an attention that you don't get if you've been writing in Watermelon Sugar, or a different kind of attention? Sure, yeah. We knew it.
I guess that's true.
Do we know nowadays that that Henry Roth, chose, by making his book really rigorous, that he wrote a classic rather than a popular novel, mm-hmm. and call it Sleep, about Brooklyn childhood?
Yeah.
Yeah. And do we know that when an author does this kind of thing, that suddenly a public is going to fall all over because suddenly they know how to talk about sociological fiction but not about art?
Well, there's something very simple that I, you know, that I've learned is true, is that people are terribly afraid of novels, and even the people who write them, and I include myself, are very afraid of novels. They're afraid of what moves them the most in reading or writing. You know, and my favorite answer to the question, "Why do you write?" Was Bernard Malamud. He said, "I'd be too moved to say." And anyone, including myself, given an opportunity to talk about John Wayne instead of the ambiguities of the characters in Girl and Landscape, you know, we'll do so, as we all did when Girl and Landscape was the book. Or to talk about Tourette syndrome is much easier than to talk about language and the really insane fact that emotion inheres in the architecture of sentences. That's mm-hmm. almost impossible to talk about.
Yeah, almost no one would say that the kind of fracturing of language because of the Tourette's syndrome in your last book, Motherless Brooklyn, was closer related to things that were going on in Finnegan's Wake than to some kind of linguistic pathology.
Right. Yeah. But Michael, I'd be failing to do justice to your question if I didn't also say that as a writer, there's a real sense of giving of myself, of wanting to open my mouth and really say what I know, and that there's an immense satisfaction in the personal, the degree to which I was able to comfortably fuse personal experience and testimony and personal concerns and witnessing, because there's just a tremendous amount of witnessing in this book, into the work, and that people are they know me better as a result. That's not small. That's a deeply satisfying experience.
I have been speaking with Jonathan Lethem, author most recently of The Fortress of Solitude, published by Doubleday. Thank you, Jonathan, for joining me.
Michael, it's a great pleasure.
You can read the first chapter of The Fortress of Solitude on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.